Welcome. You are listening to Copland. Copland is about the life and times of our protectors and defenders, police, fire, EMS, medical trauma units, and the military. The underappreciated doing the unthinkable for the often ungrateful. I am Jay Dobbins, and I'll be your host. In each season, we will hear three episodes featuring extraordinary heroes, amazing personal experiences that will inspire and uplift you. Sometimes they might shock you. The highs and lows, the successes and the failures, told in their own words and all experienced during their personal journey of sacrifice to make the world a safer place. This is Copland. Jason Schechterle's story is one we all need to hear. It reaches far beyond the first responder community. Yes, it's a cop story. It's a firefighter story. It's a medical trauma unit story. But what he experienced, endured, and now thrives behind is something that every person from every walk of life will be inspired by. Dying would have been easier. In 2001, a taxi cab traveling at over 100 miles per hour crashed into Jason's patrol car. On impact, Jason's car burst into flames and he was trapped inside. A rescue nothing short of miraculous followed. He suffered severe burns over 40% of his body, and after enduring over 50 surgeries, his physical appearance was drastically altered. Jason's resiliency, his courage, and his soul were tested. The human traits that lead us to fight for survival are demonstrated by Jason like none other, as he offers us a living, breathing example of what the human spirit is capable of. Jason's career in law enforcement was his calling, and it was inspired by the death of a police officer.
I got interested in it when I was a teenager. 16 years old. My older brother had become a Phoenix police officer, and I was one of those kids growing up that law enforcement, like, you couldn't do that job. It was bigger than life. It was superhero stuff. I mean, I'm so privileged to have grown up in the 70s and 80s, and law enforcement, of course, growing up back then, we didn't have cable TV or 24-hour news like we do now, so I definitely didn't think on the scale of, like, FBI, ATF, U.S. Marshals, good Lord, I wish I knew then what I know now, but even the local police, I was just completely enamored with them. And so I became interested, but didn't really think much of it. And played a little golf in high school, got a scholarship to a junior college in Phoenix, and then just decided I need a little structure, a little discipline in life, and I'm going to be a cop. So I'll join the military, joined the Air Force, did a great 4 years. Traveled around Korea, Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and came home, 22 years old, and just was not nearly mature enough or ready to become a police officer. And life, you know, changes on us pretty quickly. Got married, had a couple kids, ended up with a great job, Arizona Public Service, one of the two main power companies. Got an apprenticeship to be a lineman. I mean, life was really cruising for me in my mid-20s. And then on March 26th of 1999, I got home from work and turned on the news, and Phoenix police officer Mark Atkinson had been shot and killed in the line of duty that day. And people talk about their aha moments, their callings, and it was. I mean, I'm standing in my living room, work boots, long sleeve, blue collar shirt, making a bunch of money, living in a brand new house, staring at the TV, knowing I got to wear that uniform. I got to do that job. And so that's what inspired me. Went the very next day, filled out an application, and went from there.
Jason's career had barely begun before his accident. While on patrol, an unpredictable event occurred that would forever change the trajectory of his life.
My memories of my career before the accident, you know, I joke around because I still teach at the academy. I stay involved as much as I can. But, I mean, I had just got off probation. I had just got off rookie status. And every day is so new, so exciting, yet so boring at the same time. And police work's not always what you see on TV, live PD, all that stuff. And I felt like I, you know, I was just getting started. And it was still new. It was still fresh. It was like I'd been a cop for 5 minutes, is how I look back on it when the accident happened. March 26th of 2001, which this is one of the, I mean, I have a dozen things that are just ironic and mind-blowing, but 2 years to the day after Mark Axon was killed, I go to work that day. It's a Monday. I've transferred on to an afternoon shift to work with my best friend. We were partners. I've been that way for about 3 weeks, and I still remember just going to work that day like, God, life is too good. I'm 28 years old. You know, I'm happily married with a couple of beautiful kids. My parents are healthy and happily married. All four of my grandparents were alive and married. I mean, 20 years on this earth, and I got nothing. A few broken bones playing sports growing up. A few minor setbacks, but I was incredibly lucky and blessed. And it's funny, I remember leaving briefing that day, and we were short-staffed. It was a Monday. So my partner and I were not allowed to ride together. We had to be separated. And I remember being in the parking lot bitching about our sergeant, because I'm like, that's ridiculous. You know, we could be a two-man car and get stuff done. And then I left the precinct, and I was in Central City Precinct. And before I hit the button that what we call 10-8, I'm in service, available for calls. Before I did that, I drove over to Maryville Precinct, 30th Avenue in Catalina, and didn't tell anybody. Didn't really care if it was out of policy, out of procedure. It was March 26th. And I pulled up next to Mark Atkinson's memorial marker. You know, when a cop gets killed, usually there's a beautiful memorial that's put into place. And I pulled up right to the spot. He was shot and killed in his car, sitting with his seatbelt on. And just, I was there 20 seconds. I rolled down the window. I made the sign of the cross. I thanked him for his service, his sacrifice, thanked him for the opportunities that he had given me to become what I was that day, and drove away, you know, thinking nothing of it, having no idea that in about 8 hours I was going to come very close to getting my own memorial marker and being a name on the wall as well. So I went through a very quiet routine day, which I know you can relate to. This is the stupidest thing anybody can say, because there's nothing routine about law enforcement, but it truly was. I took a couple of minor car accident calls, went on a couple of paper report calls. Just was a quiet day. So ate a late dinner with my partner at the fire station. Hit the streets. Third shift was out. We're just cruising around looking for to get into some stuff. And a call came out of an unknown trouble, and it was not in my area of responsibility, so I didn't pay any attention to it. But the officers and I were busy at the time, so a few seconds later, dispatcher came back on. It was a dead body call, a lot of blood, sounded like a violent crime been committed. Couple more seconds unanswered. I'm not doing anything, so grabbed the radio and I said, I'll head that direction. Last words I ever spoken to the radio, 513 Henry, I'll start up. Lights and siren, code 3. I'm going to get there as quick as I can. And I got to 20th Street and Thomas, which is about 5 minutes east of downtown Phoenix, a pretty busy part of the valley. State Route 51 overpass, Phoenix Children's Hospital, Arizona Heart Institute. But again, it's 11:30 p.m., so not too much in the way of traffic. And as I approached the intersection, I had a red light. So even though I'm running code 3, I need to come to a complete stop to make sure that people getting on and off the freeway will yield to my emergency vehicle. It only takes a second and a half to clear an intersection. Just as I was going to proceed, my patrol car was struck from behind by a taxi cab. The driver was suffering an epileptic seizure at the time, and according to our investigators, he was doing 115 miles an hour when he ran into me. That's something I can't even really fathom. 115 in a 40 mile an hour downtown city street. I never saw the car coming. Didn't feel the impact. Thankfully, had no memory of it. I was knocked unconscious. My car, Ford Crown Victoria, burst into flames. Very susceptible to rear end fuel fed fires, and you know, I was hit at a pretty high speed, so you can imagine the devastation to this car. And traveled about 270 feet through the intersection, and then the next great miracle, I come to stop 50 feet from a fire truck that is responding to the same call that I was going to. And talk about your world truly exploding. Not mine. I'm talking about these firefighters, because, I mean, first responders have a job to do, but it's fight or flight syndrome is very real within everybody. And what a lot of people take for granted in law enforcement and firefighting is you usually know where you're headed, at least. You usually know some of the details. Car accident, guy with a gun, shoplifting, whatever it is. And this crew thinks they're going to a dead body call, pulls up to the exit of the freeway, looks to the left for oncoming traffic, and boom, a car explodes. And then they see it's a police car. And, you know, first responders, there is a lot of camaraderie, a lot of passion. Even though we give each other a hard time and joke around a lot, it's there's a certain thing about wearing one of those uniforms. And so I've always felt for them what they must have thought. And sometimes things, you know, Jay, I know you've been through things, like it takes your mind a few seconds. Am I really seeing what I'm seeing? It's surreal. And to their credit, they reacted instantly, turned their truck, drove those few feet, and went to work for me. All of them had a job to do, and they did it. I've listened to the dispatch tapes hundreds of times, and it's just incredible to listen to the chaos, but yet the poetry of how they took care of what they needed to, getting the truck prepped. One of them fighting the fire, the young rookie trying to get me out of the car. And of course, I'm unconscious. I'm trapped in my seatbelt. And then two police officers got there within about 30 seconds. And again, did not know what they were rolling up on. Then to see a police car engulfed in flames, imagine the emotions. It's one of my friends in there. That's, who is that that's dying right now? These are things I never had to go through. And as they got out of their car, the police officers, they heard this firefighter screaming, "I need a knife." So one of the officers cut my seatbelt, and I'm 6'3", weighed about 205 at the time. So getting me out of a small driver's side window is, you know, a pretty narrow fit. And my long legs, big size 13 boots, got stuck underneath the steering wheel and dashboard. And this other police officer named Brian Brooks, he crawled into the car, into the fire, wearing just a short sleeve polyester uniform to help free my legs. Going above and beyond the call of duty, I mean, I just can't say enough about the individuals who were on the scene. I had the exact right people. And they got me out of the car, in about 90 seconds, which is unbelievable. Also, as a first responder, and that takes us to the next miracle. I'm 2.5 miles away from what I will argue with anybody is the best burn center in the United States, in Maricopa County Hospital. On their trauma table in less than 8 minutes. And that's when the real nightmare began, obviously, for my family, my friends, and then eventually for me.
The aftermath, the trauma, the treatment, the recovery, the surgeries. Jason survived what very few people on the planet could ever imagine.
Burn injuries suck. I mean, there's just no two ways about it. I've never been shot. I've never been stabbed. I can't speak for other injuries, but I can tell you that burn injuries are, they're just terrible because they take things away from you that you can't get back. And one of my bigger blessings was the doctors just 100% knew I was going to die. Told my family, no way Jason's going to survive this. 4th degree burns to my neck, head, and face. 43% total body surface, shoulders to my hands. I give my bulletproof vest a lot of credit and saved my life because my chest had been burned anything like my face or arms, I would have died within just a couple minutes, but my torso was unharmed. And they had me out of the car so quick that and being unconscious, I wasn't in fear. I wasn't fighting and screaming and trying to get out of the car myself. I wasn't sucking in that hot smoke. So that helped a lot to keep my lungs somewhat clear. And so because of the extent of the injuries and the thought that I was going to die and the surgeries that I'm facing, the doctors just simply told my family, we're going to put him into a medically induced coma, and we got to get all of that dead bacteria-filled tissue off. That's the big danger with burns. So you got to remove everything. But then once you remove everything, trying to overcome that loss of fluids and that loss of protection is usually what gets people. A lot of times, burn survivors will only survive, you know, 5, 6, 7 weeks, and then they eventually will succumb to their injuries because of infections or whatever. And that medical coma, though, was a huge blessing for me because I did not have to experience the initial pain, fear, and surgeries. And I ended up being in that coma for 2.5 months, which is really hard to fathom because it wasn't a head injury. It wasn't a coma, at least mine. It's the only way I can explain it is blink your eye, and that's it. I mean, I woke up. They woke me up, but when I woke up, I was as clear-headed as I am talking to you. I mean, I'm like, why am I in the hospital? I knew the sound and the smells. I knew where I was. Why can't I open my eyes? Why can't I move? I got thousands of thoughts just instantly pouring into my mind. I was just at work. What the hell is going on? And that's when I was told very slowly by people around me, my wife, my friends, my dad, what had taken place. And yeah, it was obviously it's been 19 years this month, and looking back on it, you know, I just, like I described the firefighters, surreal. What? No, that's not possible. And then fire. That's the only thing I've ever been scared of. The only thing that I've ever prayed would not happen. The only thing I've ever said, no way can I handle that. And you're telling me that's what happened? Well, it's a car accident, so my legs were burnt. Not so bad. Even though I can't see, it was still like a too much to comprehend. Well, I'm just, for some reason, I'm not opening my eyes, and I'm not sure why yet. I'll figure that out later. I mean, it was just the back and forth between very grim and devastating news being poured onto me to not even being able to comprehend what I'm being told. And it went that way for several weeks for me to fully understand the magnitude of what had happened. And again, I keep talking about blessings and things I'm thankful for. Another one was being black. You know, I thank God to this day I did not wake up from a coma with the burn injuries that I had, entirely lost my physical appearance. Draw a circle on my collar and erase everything up. That's what they did. My nose, my ears, my eyelids, everything was removed. Had I woke up from my coma and looked in a mirror, man, there's no way I'd have mentally recovered from that. So my blindness was, at the time, I mean, the most claustrophobic, terrifying thing I've ever experienced is that total darkness. But what an incredible blessing it was to be given the time I needed to understand and mentally prepare for what I was going to see and get to the realizations that I needed to decide that I was ready to put up a fight.
What reveals those character traits that we may not realize we possess?
You know, that is an excellent question that I have thought about endlessly over the years, because I look back on it and I just was absolutely not prepared for this or any kind of life-changing adversity. I had it too good. I was too lucky for too many years. And, you know, I had a great childhood, great parents, went to good schools, played sports, just all that stuff. Really believed in service, loved being in the military, loved being a cop. It was my calling. And so all that helped, but I, you know, looking back, I didn't think of myself as this anything special, any kind of special strength or courage. I wasn't raised in a real religious background. There was just, I don't want to say there wasn't a foundation of this, because I don't want to discredit the way I was raised and growing up here, because, you know, I had a great life going. But there's no way, if you'd have told me this is going to happen, that I would have said, oh yeah, you know, I can handle that. It was more after the fact, and it helped a lot for me to be 28 years old, to have a career that mattered to other people, to have your story covered on the news, to have friends and agencies and a community rally around your family, to have the doctors that I did, and to have to be a dad. I mean, that resonated with me. Like, you know, Jason, you've been in a coma for 2.5 months, and these people are still here. You have no idea what they've gone through for those 2.5 months, so you have no right to give up on them. And that kind of gave me a little bit of energy. And then I came to some realizations about the choices that I had made. You know, I did not catch on fire because in a sad, twisted, magical instant, some guy ran into me. I was in that hospital bed because of so many choices that I had made all the way back to high school, giving up my college scholarship, joining the military, only spending 4 years in the military, postponing becoming a cop until I was moved to do so by the death of Mark Atkinson. All those choices over all those years is what got me to that hospital bed. And that, along with, it's going to sound a little strange, but I'm like, you know what? Instead of why me, why not me? And I would not remove myself or my car from that intersection and let that guy go another half mile to the next intersection and take out somebody's grandparents or a woman with her kids, and they wouldn't have been as lucky as me to survive. So those are the two things that really propelled me. And they both came to me one night at the end of June. I'd been awake for about 3 weeks, and I was all alone, blind, no visitors in the middle of the night. And those two things dawned on me. And I was like, you know what? I'm ready to fight. Probably not going to accomplish much. And, you know, I'm not, at the time, I'm thinking, it wasn't real positive, but I was going to at least fight and just go 1 hour at a time, 1 day at a time, 1 surgery at a time, 1 painful, frustrating therapy at a time. And then when I get there, then I'll see what's next. And then the positive momentum started going, and once that took off, it's been unstoppable ever since. Adversity, tragedy, challenges, it doesn't define or shape your character, it reveals it. And so, I'm very proud of that, because I don't even think I knew myself. I didn't know what I was capable of. I didn't know my true self, my heart, my soul, my own demons, my own thoughts. None of them had ever come to the surface. None of them had ever needed to. So I'm very proud, obviously, now, knowing what I know. You know, what I didn't know then was okay. But what's been revealed to me has also helped me a lot. And again, it's not, I'm definitely not the strongest, not the bravest, not the most courageous, and or the toughest people you're going to meet. I could rattle off a long list of people who are much tougher and have been through what I think is a lot more than me. But I'm pretty proud of how everybody around me handled this, allowing people to fight for me when I needed it. You know, I think there's a tremendous amount of strength and beauty inside of vulnerability. But most of us don't want to be vulnerable. We hate it. It doesn't feel good. We're not proud of it. It's a difficult place to be. But we're going to be there. We're all going to be there. And to let other people fight for you when you can't fight is a pretty amazing thing. So, I look back over these years, and one of the beautiful things about our minds and the human spirit is I don't even remember much about those dark days or the pain. What I remember is the support that I had from my family, from my friends, from the law enforcement community. Then, you know, I got to carry the Olympic torch, which I was very humbled by that, because I only got to do that because of the uniform I was wearing and the job that I was doing. And why isn't Mark Atkinson here carrying the torch? Why isn't Skip Fink from the Department of Public Safety or Juan Cruz, who caught on fire and did not have a fire truck in the intersection, why aren't they here doing this? So it was humbling, but it also gave me a tremendous amount of inspiration and some great memories. Then we had a baby 18 months after the accident. Now you really get into perspective. For me, I mean, I spent 18 months just kind of scraping through each day, clawing my way forward, trying to fight. And believe me, there was a lot of bad days. I mean, my wife and I would get in some crazy screaming fights, me wanting to give up, sit in my chair, my life is wasted, I can't go back to work, just all this stuff. I had a three-year-old son. He turned three when I was in my coma, and he would actually say, "You're not my dad." And let me tell you, as a father, that is, there is no other rock bottom than hearing one of your children not be able to acknowledge that you're their parent, and the overwhelming guilt that I felt with that. I know why I put my name on the application. I'm very proud of it. But my children didn't ask for that. Children asked me to change or interrupt their lives. And so I had that to deal with. So when our third child was born 18 months later, I finally, you know, selfishly and personally got the perspective that I needed, because I could look at this baby when he was 1 day old, 1 week old, and realize that, okay, what those firefighters did, how they risked their lives, the police officers, my doctors, my family, we're no longer talking about getting me out of a car or getting me through one or two surgeries. We're talking about an entire life that really shouldn't even exist in my son. And then I thought way ahead, well, what if he grows up and has three or four children? What if they grow up and have three or four children? It is a life uninterrupted, and it can go on and on for generations. There's no logical end to the beauty of what took place. And for all these years, I've gotten to watch this kid grow up. He's now, you know, 6'1", 170-pound, very good baseball player, trying to get a college scholarship, junior in high school, and being his dad has been one of the greatest things ever. And every day when I see him, he's got a game today that I'm going to watch. And not for a second do I think about my appearance. Not for a second do I think about my limited eyesight or the fact that I'm not a cop anymore. It's the perspective that I need to get through everything. 2 weeks after he was born, I did go back to work, though. Because, and this is the one thing, nobody, not my doctors, not my friends, not my family, not one person thought that I'd go back to work. Obviously, with the way I looked, being blind, losing half my fingers to amputation, the rest of my hands being ridiculously deformed. But law enforcement is a calling. It damn well should be. If it's not, then you shouldn't be doing it. It was not a paycheck or some benefits or 40 hours a week. It was who I was 24 hours a day. I was a Phoenix police officer. And I'm going back to work. And 2 weeks after my son was born, so November 12th of 02, 18 months after the accident, not only did I go back to work, I got into a truck by myself and drove back to work. And I was determined to make the most of my career. Ended up being a public information officer, and then got invited to join the Phoenix Police Homicide Unit, which was a dream and a goal of mine, something I was very proud of. Is an incredibly honorable job to speak for victims who can't speak for themselves, to work with families affected by that kind of violence. I had an incredible chain of command, gave me a lot of opportunities to learn. I worked my way up to where I was never a lead investigator, but I was the scene investigator for our squad, and I was involved in a lot of incredible cases, a lot of high-profile cases, a lot of work, again, so much bigger than myself, that provides energy and motivation and worthiness. And I was able to do that for several years. And finally, 5.5 years after the accident, for several different reasons, I realized that I wouldn't be able to do the job not only the way I wanted to, but the way I had planned. 20, 25, 30 years. And so I retired in August of 2006.
Only the hand of God and his perfect plan can explain how, and more importantly, why Jason survived.
was not raised ever a religious background. But from the time I woke up, I was never, it wasn't why me. There was no anger at God. There was no, I just didn't have to deal with that. And also, I was incredibly lucky in the sense that this guy who hit me was having an epileptic seizure. He was not targeting or trying to hurt a police officer. He was not trying to hurt Jason. So a lot of first responders out there come in contact with people who are intentionally saying, you're not going home tonight. And that is a powerful thing. That's an entire different set of circumstances that you might have to deal with some anger or some PTS, which there's no D on the end of that. And I know other people say that it is not a disorder, it's an injury. I didn't have that injury, thankfully. So fast forward to not long after I got out of the hospital, I am sitting at home one night listening, I'm blind, listening to the TV, and there's a show on that, because I'm blind, I'm not paying much attention to. I'm just sitting in my chair, can't really move. You know, I shrunk down to about 120 pounds. I was frail, I was sick, I was blind. I was just, I was, talk about a hot mess, and that was me. And all of a sudden this story comes on, and it was an actor in the show telling this story of the drowning man. And I listened to it, and it just, I'm like, that's it. That's me. That's what we're talking about. And I kind of kept it with me until I could see again, until I could read the real version. And basically what the drowning man is, it's not a guy sitting on his rooftop and the town is flooding, and a rowboat comes by and throws him a rope, says, hey, swim over here, I'm going to take you to safety. And the guy says, no, I'm praying to God, I believe in God, he'll take care of me. So the rowboat leaves, a speedboat comes by, same thing, throws him a rope. Guy says, no, I have faith in God, I believe in God, I'll be fine. Speedboat leaves, helicopter flies over, drops down a ladder, climb up here, fly you to safety. Same thing. Guy says, no, I'm praying to God, he'll take care of me. Well, the waters finally rise up and the guy drowns. And he gets into heaven. He's pretty upset, demands an audience with God. And when he gets in front of God, he says, God, I believed in you, I have faith in you. How do you let this happen to me? And God said, I gave you a rowboat, a speedboat, and a helicopter. What the hell are you doing here? And that is exactly how I live my life. I had a fire truck at my intersection. I had the doctors. I had the wife. I had the kids. I had the career, the job. I have had everything that I need right in front of me. And I think we all do. It's a choice to use it and to see it. God does not fly planes into buildings. God does not, one of the things that annoys me, you know, I appreciate and respect that people do things to make themselves feel better, but I'm a huge football fan. I watch a field goal kicker make the sign of the cross before a field goal, then I start giggling. I'm like, you know, God didn't go to Vegas and put money down on the spread. He ain't going to help you. He doesn't give a shit if you make this field goal or not. That's just how I, on a big scale, from 9/11 all the way up to a stupid football game, that's just how I view it. We are allowed to make our own choices, live our own free will. We're not free from the consequences of our choices. And there are two things, Jay, that I want to feel and I search for every day. And I'm not always successful, but I want to feel peace and serenity. And having that knowledge that, you know, I put a post on one of my social media sites not too long ago that said, I may have caught on fire, but I didn't drown. And that was what I was referring to as that story. I just simply believe that God puts everything that we need in place, but it's up to you to use it.
Regret is not something that Jason carries with him, and his achievements are countless. The foremost is his family.
To be honest with myself and all your listeners, I'd have to say I I don't have a greatest regret. But I say that from the standpoint of now being 47 years old and having the life that I do, looking at my kids and understanding that nothing would be happening right now if the past wasn't exactly the way that it was. So I can't find a regret, even if I try to search. I mean, there's little things. I'll talk about my youngest son, who, you know, my other two kids are off doing their thing. They've got their careers. My youngest son is still kind of like, you know, I'm thinking about law enforcement, maybe on the federal side, and oh, man, I'll jump on him. I'm like, listen, if I had to do over again, I'd be a United States Marshal, or I'd be an ATF agent. And I talked to him about that, but I don't regret that I didn't know about that or that I didn't do that. So I don't speak in it in that way. I can honestly say I don't have any regrets, because life is just, I wouldn't change anything. I got to walk my daughter down the aisle a couple of years ago. Not a lot of dads get to do that, or can. And until you've done it, you can't fathom what it feels like. Nobody can explain it. I got to do that. So I have no regrets. My greatest achievement in life is easily being a father and seeing what my kids are doing, all of them. My daughter's in a medical program doing developmental child psychology to help kids affected by similar trauma that she had gone through at 7 years old. My middle son has overcome a tremendous amount of adversity. You know, he turned 3 when I was in a coma, and he grew up with a lot of anxiety, severe eating disorder, and to see where he's at now and what he's doing in life is just, he's my biggest inspiration by far. Proof every day that you can overcome your adversity. And then watching my youngest son, my athlete, and the work we do every day, the practice, the dreams about college, easily my biggest achievement. There's nothing in this world like fatherhood, and I'm very thankful. And the short answer to that question is, I could die tomorrow and I will leave this world better than I found it because of my 3 kids. So that's my greatest achievement.
Jason Schechterle has a very simple way of explaining very complex circumstances as his guide to a life well lived.
Yeah, my message is very simply that life is 10% what happens to you, and it's 90% how you react to it. And there's just not a lot we're in control of in life. Very few things, but we are in control of our attitude all the time. And to realize that we won't always win the battle, we won't always have the best attitude, we won't always treat people the way we want to, we won't always be the strong, successful person we want to be. But every day that we wake up, we do get to learn. We do get to make better versions of ourselves. And for first responders now, you know, a lot of times I can play devil's advocate. And again, I teach at the academy, so I'm looking at these wide-eyed recruits. And I remember what it's like to sit in those chairs. And I tell them on one hand, listen, you signed up for this. You put your name on that application just like I did, and whatever comes from here on out, you need to accept that because that was your choice. However, you know, that's the harsh way of looking at it, and it's fair, I think. But on the other side of that is you do put your name on the application. You do want to serve. It is your calling. You do want to help people. All these grand things, the fun, romantic things that you see on TV, well, then you get out there. And, I mean, go down the list of what can happen. The first time you see a dead baby, the first time you see a mangled body in a car, the first time you're not able to save a life, first time somebody points a gun at you, or God forbid, you have to take somebody's life. That's what is not written on the application. And until you go through those things, you don't know what you're going to feel. I can only speak from the side of being injured in the line of duty and not having the full career. But you see it all the time right now with the suicide rate is out of control, the divorce rate, alcoholism, drug use. It's just ridiculous. And we have to be able to take care of ourselves. And I think just for anybody out there, and I have this, you know, I love cliches because I think they're powerful. I think they mean something. There's a reason that people repeat these things over and over and over. And I had one dawn on me that I can call my own. And I mean, I've got it tattooed all the way down my forearm so I can look at it every day. And it simply says, the most beautiful inspirational changes will disguise themselves as utter devastation. Be patient. And that's what I've been able to do now, again, 19 years later. It's easy for me to say that, right? I'm in my chapter 30, and I could be talking to somebody in your audience, your listeners, who are in their chapter 1. And they can't see the outcome. I've gotten to my outcome. So I respect how difficult it is because I was there. But if you're patient and you believe in yourself and let other people fight for you, you can get through anything. And life, just because it doesn't work out exactly the way you planned, doesn't mean that it's not worth living. I mean, I was only cop for 7 years. I see what my friends are doing right now. One's my best friend's a commander now. Another one's teaching at the academy. I see them getting their gray hair and, just moving on with their careers. And I'm like, oh, I wonder what I'd be doing right now. Wonder what I'd look like right now. And it'll be a fleeting thought, a little smile across my face, but wouldn't go back. Wouldn't do it over. I got to do it for the amount of time that I did, the amount of time I deserved. I was lucky, I was blessed, I cherish it, and now I'm on to the next chapters, and I think everybody should just continue to read their own book, write their own chapters, and stay in the fight.
Do your organization a favor. Bring Jason Schechterly to speak to your people. Let them hear his story. It is even more powerful when he delivers it in person. Inspire them to overcome every obstacle and setback with dignity and go beyond survival, but to thrive in spite of our hardships, knowing that our best is always out in front of us. You can find Jason at burningshield.com, where you can also find a link to his best-selling book by the same name. Copland is produced for those courageous men and women whose alarm clock goes off every day. They put their feet on the ground, buckle on gear, and kiss their families goodbye with no guarantee they will ever come home. They go willingly, facing predators and violence on behalf of good and innocent people who simply want to live safe, peaceful lives. Thank you for listening. God bless and go be amazing.